It's the 30th of January, 2016, and this is episode 280. This show is intended for informational and educational purposes only. Cryptocurrency is new, exciting, and empowering, but we're not experts, just obsessed companions walking the road towards a more peer-to-peer future. On today's episode of Let's Talk Bitcoin, we're getting controversial, with the second half of the show devoted to a discussion about the recent RAND report on why terrorist organizations and non-state actors might want to use a Bitcoin-like system. But first, Bitcoin was the best-performing currency of 2015. It ended the year up 35%, and that compares against really every other world currency out there. The next best-performing one, relatively speaking, is the Israeli currency, is the Israeli shekel, I think. They were up 0.3% on the year, but everybody else was flat or down. Japan and Switzerland were both 0%, and then China was down 4.2%.
I'm just remembering all these headlines last year of Bitcoin being the worst performing currency. You know, it's both the best and the worst, depending on what year it is.
Well, I think the thing that's relevant here is that it's not about Bitcoin. It's almost entirely about everybody else. And
right.
Bitcoin kind of sets itself apart by being, you know, whether for good or for bad, disconnected from the rest of the world currencies. So it means that it just fundamentally is on a different level, is operating under different fundamentals than everybody else is.
Yeah. And at the same time, this whole headline thing is completely meaningless. Bitcoin is one of the more volatile currencies out there and will continue to be as long as it's adoption is still in its infancy. It's growing very well, but it's still a tiny currency, and tiny currencies get pushed around by, you know, the prevailing winds in the markets out there. Bitcoin's winds might be different. Maybe it has a different configuration of sales, so it responds to different winds than everything else, which is why you see it doing things like going up when other currencies go down. You may even see the emergence, perhaps, of this safe haven characteristic. It's still too early to tell, but I think we're seeing some flight from the yuan to the dollar, and from the yuan to precious metals, and from the yuan to Bitcoin. And so it is beginning to act a bit like a global currency safe haven. But before we pop the champagne and celebrate Bitcoin having its best year ever, I will not assume that 2016 won't be its worst year ever, followed by its best year ever, followed by its worst year ever. What it is going to be is a roller coaster ride, and will continue to be like that for a while.
Says the guy who literally had a champagne party when Bitcoin hit a price milestone. What was it? $100 or $200?
No, it was like $450 something. I mean, like, that was what it wound up being by the time the party happened.
I may be accused of using the price of Bitcoin as an excuse to drink champagne with my friends.
Well, I don't think we have to worry too much about Bitcoin having its best year anytime in the near future. In 2013, it gained 5,429% year to year. So we got a ways to go. In 2014, it was down 56%. In 2015, it was up 35%.
But like you said, those numbers are kind of meaningless. You know, you can create big percentages, but it's a different animal. You can't really describe Bitcoin in terms of the way that other currencies are described, because it's something new.
The really meaningful thing, however, is not what's happening in Bitcoin. The really interesting thing is that we're living in an unprecedented global currency crisis that has been rolling out now for 8 to 10 years and is getting worse. We're living in the most acute currency wars since the beginning of the 20th century, which led to two world wars. We're living at a time when deflation has gripped a third of the global currencies, and you have a race to the bottom. And the really important thing is that for all of these other currencies that are doing very poorly and are creating these very difficult conditions in their local economies, they are monopoly systems that people cannot opt out from. And Bitcoin is opt-in. So the only people affected by Bitcoin's crazy roller coaster ride are the opt-in, well, somewhat crazy people, some say, who decided to put some of their money in Bitcoin. No one's being forced to do it. But guess what? There's entire countries, I would actually say probably the entire continent of South America at the moment, where these currency monopolies are taking massive populations hostage on a great deflation or great hyperinflation ride that destroys generational wealth. And if you ask a Greek, a Cypriot, an Argentinian, a Venezuelan, they're well familiar with the three times in a generation destruction of all wealth in the middle class. It's happened. It keeps happening. And for them, this is the really important news. Who cares what Bitcoin is doing? Which is why, you know, Bitcoin success is not dependent just on Bitcoin. Maybe it's just about Bitcoin survival in a world where currencies are melting down all around.
Totally agree with that. It's really about Bitcoin being there as an alternative as it becomes more obvious that what we have thought for all of our lives, you know, and obviously the countries you mentioned are different that have had personal experiences with sudden devaluations and multiple times. But that's kind of the thing, is people still perceive government-backed money to be a safe and stable store of value. And in practice, we're seeing all over the world that not only is it not a stable store of value, but they are all acting basically in concert to keep people trapped in, you know, this situation. Because again, if everybody is devaluing at the same time, then it's all kind of relative. So that's really what makes Bitcoin stand out, is there's nobody, Bitcoin not being a centrally managed currency can't respond, even when the situation is so bad that, oh my God, we need to do stimulus, or oh my God, the situation is so bad that we need to devalue to, you know, to help with these debts. It just doesn't fundamentally at a basic level work that way with Bitcoin. And that's the real differentiating factor that I think is becoming more and more apparent.
Not that Bitcoin should be perceived as some kind of safe store of value either, but it's offering another option for diversification that isn't subject to the same political pressures that pretty much every other currency out there is.
Right. It's the only thing one can think of that's both has some sort of credibility and also is stable, is not stable in terms of price, but is stable in terms of long-term policy decision-making.
The other interesting thing is when you said that we perceive central banking as stable, yet there are these exceptions. You know, the stability of central banking is the exception, because out of 194 currencies, you can count maybe a dozen that have been stable over a period of more than 20 or 30 years, and every single other currency. So the rule of centrally managed currencies is deflation followed by hyperinflation, followed by deflation, followed by hyperinflation, political meddling, geopolitical games, and wiping out generational wealth. The exception is the North American experience and the Western European experience of stable currencies that so far have lasted more than 30 years. But even that may end up now being proven wrong.
Whereas this may have been more of a theoretical concern in the past for some people around the world, now we're seeing in nations where there's a lot of oil wealth and the value of the national currency is kind of tied to commodity prices with oil, or even in a place like Canada where a lot of the food is imported and they're going through sort of a currency panic right now where the Canadian dollar is devaluing and it's getting harder for people to buy basic necessities. Now these problems are becoming very real, at least for some people around the world. We're forced to confront the idea and question the idea that these central bank national fiat currencies are not actually the stable store of value that they have been supposed to be, and we've been told that they are for so long.
Ironically, this is having another interesting effect, which is that a few weeks ago, the Federal Reserve, for the first time, as the media said, increased the interest rate. Well, actually, they didn't. They set a different target for the interest rate. And they're hoping that their actions will cause the banks that actually have most of the liquidity to pass on interest rate increases to their customers so that it actually affects the economy. So it's like they set the cruise control, but we don't know yet if the velocity of the car will actually change to what they want it to change. And the big question is whether the Federal Reserve actually has the power to drain liquidity, in effect, increase inflation to a level that pushes the currency value a tiny bit down. And the reason for this is to make the dollar more competitive, to make exports more competitive, to deal with trade imbalances, to deal with asset bubbles and all of the other things that have been happening. But while the US is trying to do this, the yuan, which is our primary trading partner, China, has been devaluing rapidly. And what that does is it actually exports deflation to the United States. So while the US is trying to create a bit of inflation and stop these deflationary pressures that have made asset bubbles explode everywhere. At the same time, by China devaluing their currency, they're pushing the US back into deflationary status. So this is the race to the bottom. This is exactly what we mean by currency race to the bottom, with currencies competing with devaluations. They're all trying to depress the value of their currency at the moment in order to reduce the debt load on national governments, in order to reduce the repayments of debt, in order to increase consumption and reduce savings. And in all of those cases, all these countries are failing, because as one devalues, another devalues and matches. It's a race to the bottom.
Devaluation in China equals deflation here, right? And you're talking about that like it's a not desirable thing. But in practice, what that means is that Chinese goods get cheaper. So it seems like that would be a net positive, except that everybody has this problem and everybody needs to devalue. So if, again, like we had a system that wasn't so connected and everybody is trying to do the same thing so that there are no alternatives, no competition, again, within the global system, then this wouldn't be a problem. But it's because everybody is so linked together that it makes it so that China doing this means that we have to do it even harder, which means that they have to do it even harder. And like you said, a race to the bottom.
The real question is, good for who? Who is inflation good for? Who is deflation good for? And inflation is good if you have a massive debt load in US dollars, because then that debt repayment becomes smaller and smaller because the value of each currency unit is lower. So for a government that has enormous debt, inflation is good. For savers, however, inflation is bad. And effectively, creating inflationary conditions is a hidden tax on savers, where you transfer value from people who have been saving all their life and being frugal to people who have enormous unsustainable debt loads. So when we say, you know, the US government is trying to create inflation because inflation is good, it's good for the US government.
Well, whatever they do is going to be good for a political class. All these dynamics are so complicated. The world is so interconnected, and there are all these central banks that are trying to tweak things in the economy to benefit their best interests and the best interests of their respective governments. And when you kind of zoom out on that, it's almost ridiculous or unfathomable to think that a group of people, no matter how much supposed expertise they have, could even deign to kind of control something like the value of a currency, or to try to steer this economy in the way that they want. And Bitcoin is subject to none of those political forces. Bitcoin is all, you know, governed by market forces, which makes it so special and unique. As a market, well, it's the integration of a lot of signals from everyone all at once, and nobody's controlling it in a top-down sense. It balances itself out. It finds an equilibrium. That is so in contrast to the idea of central banks kind of trying to guide economic actions in the way that they see fit.
Hey, folks. Episode 280 of Let's Talk Bitcoin is brought to you by the LTB Network Marketplace, where you can support the Let's Talk Bitcoin show by becoming a sponsor, buying a logo, t-shirt, or sweatshirt, having Stephanie make you a custom phone greeting or narration for your project, or of course, scheduling a phone consultation with me to explore how your project or business can incorporate tokens for good and for awesome. The magic word for today's episode is cone. Visit letstalkbitcoin.com to enter it for your share of the listener rewards. On another note, I'm getting ready to release my second collection of odd music on the Happy Birthday EP. This song is track 2, it's called Lessons. If you'd like to learn more about my music, you can visit mindtomatter.org to find out all the details. Enjoy!
Here's the lesson, the first thing to do is to flap your eyes faster, yeah, you hear it going on now. Running lightly, gaining slightly, and there's just one thing left. Taking flight is finally within your grasp. Nobody said this would be easy. Our wings are tired, we've been beating nonstop for months. Gravity shifts, we start to lift. What used to work becomes fun, becomes fun, becomes fun, becomes, becomes fun. We shot your bag and chose to push back on the gate. We've been nice, much so far. Here's the lesson. The first thing to do is to clap your hands faster. Yeah, you hear it all around. Taking flight means gaining slightly, and there's just one thing left. You jump the boundary just this once. Nobody said this would be easy. Our voices tired, we've been saying this years too long. Gravity shifts, we're lost to drought. Life used to work is mostly gone.
Recently, the RAND Corporation, an influential global policy think tank with strong defense and homeland security ties, unquote, released a report entitled National Security Implications of Virtual Currency. And the report was made available freely online and is a little over 100 pages long and is a couple of things, but is a pretty, you know, well put together report, actually, on the potential of virtual currencies, of a lot of the realities about it right now. And then it kind of gets into some interesting speculation, at least I thought it was interesting speculation, about ways that new virtual currencies, this was a distinction that wasn't really covered in many of the articles. Really, the report is talking about virtual currencies that might be based on Bitcoin or something like it, but that are not Bitcoin. Things that would be created expressly for a non-state organization, which is shorthand for terrorist group or insurgent or rebel or whatever you want to call it, to essentially do all of the things with cryptocurrency that we know, which is have a stable, viable system for transactions and personal finance that is outside of whatever the system is of the country that you happen to reside in. Andreas, I know that you read the entire thing, and I got through about half of it before we got to this recording. What was your takeaway from it?
Just to clarify, I skimmed the entire thing. I read the bits that I found most interesting as I was skimming it. It's a well-written, very interesting report, and it's well in line with previous reports by the RAND Corporation. What did you call them? A global respected...
An influential global policy think tank with strong defense and homeland security ties, unquote.
That's hilarious. That is just hilarious. If you ever wanted to find out who the brains of the military-industrial complex are, the RAND Corporation is sitting right in there. This is an organization that has been writing strategic reports for intelligence and defense for decades, and they are the definition of conservatism. The foundational assumption in all of these reports is the preservation of global hegemony and power of the United States in air, sea, and land, information systems, and everything else. Distrust for anything that is either new or in any way threatens global domination by the United States.
That sounds like neoconservatism, but yeah, I'm not
yeah,
really arguing.
Yeah, I was going to say neoconservatism rather than conservatism,
right.
But
that's exactly the kind of conservative. So if Dick Cheney had a think tank, this is it. This kind of organization has been writing these reports for you. You should see what they said about the internet. You know, they are the definition of curmudgeons. They think all change is terrible. And the report, I think in many ways, reflects that, which is that nowhere there is the possibility of thinking about these currencies in terms of the advantages they would offer in liberalizing and removing control from adversaries. I mean, it is there, but it's downplayed. And the real thing is, you know, what if adversaries use these kinds of things against us? Really, it's a report about Hezbollah coin, if you want to call it that.
But the problem with that is, though, you know, the definition of terrorists morphs to fit whatever political agenda. You know, we're all terrorists now, even if we're nonviolent, but just something like using Bitcoin or being interested in it or thinking that yeah, maybe the current banking system doesn't always serve my best interests or whatever.
No, the definition of terrorist never changes for Rand. Terrorist is whoever uses armed resistance to American global hegemony.
It's non-state actors. I mean, we should specify that. They use the word terrorist in there a couple of times, but the generic term for it is non-state actor, which is a group that competes with a state actor, right? So that's kind of the relevant part about
this.
But
even if that's what they mean, whoever's interpreting their report in the U.S. government or whatever, you know, they're constantly talking about domestic terrorists, and that could be whoever they want.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's really focused. If you read the report, it is really focused on foreign non-state actors. It's exactly the kind of report, if you wanted someone to think up the most paranoid nightmare scenario that could threaten the United States and put it down in a report. And, you know, that's the job that they're given. And in that, they executed. They created the most paranoid fantasy of what might happen in the future possible based on these digital currencies. And so they served their purpose. Now, the problem is, if you go and read this report and that's all you take from it and you don't understand the operating assumptions behind the report, then, you know, you would see Bitcoin and other digital currencies as something horrifically threatening, in the same way that if you read the report about the various reports they wrote over the years about the internet, about anonymity on the internet and things like that, you would assume the same things. Basically, any technology and any tool, if held by adversaries and giving them power, control, the opportunity to cause mischief, is a bad tool. And it's relentlessly cynical and paranoid worldview and fails to see any possible good happening from any form of change. As long as you're aware of that, it's a great report.
If we look at what they've written about the internet, yes, there are people within the government who believe that the internet still is a series of tubes that can get clogged up and don't have very high opinions of the internet or a very modern understanding of what the internet is and what it does. But it hasn't stopped the internet from existing, right? And it hasn't stopped crime over the internet. And this wouldn't stop Bitcoin from existing.
Well, yes, but here's the most explosive and controversial part of this, which is the recommended countermeasures, which are the disrupt, decoy, deny, and deceive type operations on these currencies.
Right, but the paranoid libertarians have beat them to it because they already thought the government was doing that anyway. and maybe there's some evidence that they have been.
Every moment in history, 20 years later, we find out that they have been. It would be absolutely naive to assume that this is the one moment in history where they decided to drop these tactics. And that's not just the US government. It's every government in the world since the beginning of history. But the point of this is that what they're talking about very specifically is denial of service attacks. And the really interesting thing is that they admit that these denial of service attacks will not be, the systems cannot be effectively shut down, and these denial of service attacks will be temporary in nature as the systems will evolve to counteract them.
And mostly focused against centralized players too. The people who they would be attacking in this circumstance wouldn't be Bitcoin or wouldn't be another type of cryptocurrency. It would be the mining pools. It would be the merchant services that are providing kind of back-end support, not the actual core infrastructure, because you basically can't do an effective denial of service attack, as you're saying. But there are still centralized components within this.
And to that point, this is the one area of the report where I think they did not serve their audience well. Because what they did is they looked one step ahead. And they said, okay, so these things exist. They're in the hands of adversaries, non-state actors, whatever you want to call them, and they're using them to do things that the United States doesn't like. So here's how to attack them. Great. What they haven't talked about, which I think is really important, is what happens next. And what happens next is when you attack a dynamic system that is adaptive and that is based on software.
It gets more resilient.
Exactly. They didn't discuss the evolutionary impact of narrow focused attacks on the centralized parts of these currencies will have, because if you attack the centralized parts, you create exactly the environmental pressure you need in a system that is basically operating by evolutionary dynamics to evolve resistance to that. And the way it evolves resistance to that is by decentralizing the very functions you attack.
In fact, there have been many instances throughout the history of Bitcoin. It happens nearly every month, you know.
Right. Silk Road to Open Bazaar.
Yeah, exactly. Where there's all kinds of attacks, denial of service attacks included against various parts of the Bitcoin ecosystem. And it hasn't killed Bitcoin yet. In fact, it's referred to as a stress test often. And what comes out of that is being better equipped to deal with those kind of stress tests in the future.
Yes, all of these systems keep getting stronger. And I get asked all the time, why doesn't someone attack Bitcoin with attack X or attack Y? Like spending lots of little transactions to clog the network, et cetera, et cetera.
And you mean no one's done that yet? Oh, why didn't they think of that?
And the reason is because they have been doing that from the very beginning and almost constantly. And so the system has all kinds of measures to defend against that. But the report correctly identifies the centralized aspects of these digital currencies as being the weakest. And what it doesn't do is take the next obvious step, which is if you attack these centralized systems, you are going to force them to decentralize. And now we have the technology to do it effectively. Whether that's going from Napster to BitTorrent, the lesson that the music industry failed to learn and now the movie industry is failing to learn, or it's shutting down the Silk Road, just getting 20 alternatives pop up the next day, and then the development of various completely decentralized open markets as an immediate response to that. And this is going to continue to happen. Decentralized, network-centric, evolutionary systems cannot be attacked in these ways. They've actually picked a very weak form of response, a form that is going to be ineffective in the short run and counter-effective in the long run, creating exactly the opposite of what they're trying to achieve. So, they didn't serve their audience, which is really disappointing.
The big problem that they have with virtual currency in general, and really the whole reason behind this report, is not that, alternatives to a system, to given systems are inherently wrong. It's that they're alternatives that can't be disrupted by a state actor or government when they want to. And that's kind of the thing, is like, you could have e-gold. E-gold could exist, but they could shut it down at the point that they wanted to shut it down. Whereas something like this, again, like that's why they've got this nip it in the bud approach, as far as I can tell, is because there is a recognition here that once these things get going and get momentum unto themselves, they are very difficult to disrupt. But at that early point where they still lack legitimacy, that's a time when it's viable to attack them either preemptively or just to, the other options, of course, are beyond denial of service attacks, are to do things like to compromise at a basic hardware level where you infiltrate essentially the hardware manufacturers and you do something to the hardware so that it either, you have the ability to control it or it degrades faster over time or, something like that. And there were a couple of other ways to attack it too. Compromise the software, for example. Bitcoin or one of these things, are primarily open source. So if you can infiltrate your way in and then get into the base of the technology and then get something added that doesn't look like it's bad, but then, a year, 5 years, 10 years later, then it turns out to be something bad, then that's another way that you can disrupt these things too. But it was all very focused on stopping them before they actually get going.
And once again, ignoring, in the great tradition of the American military-industrial complex, ignoring blowback, which is what happens when you take actions like that.
Preemptive strike. Where have we heard that before? Yeah.
And well, we just don't recognize blowback at a fundamental level.
But blowback happens in other ways that are more subtle now. Increasingly, in an interconnected technology world, blowback comes back and bites American companies. So what we're seeing now is what this is doing in many cases now is pitting the defense industry, the military-industrial complex, against the Silicon Valley industry. You've seen that in the end-to-end encryption fights. You've seen that in the response to the NSA wiretapping fiber optic connections between Google data centers, Yahoo data centers, and Apple. You've seen that in the attempts to weaken cryptographic standards like the NIST elliptic curve random number generator, which just recently was found to be compromised with a backdoor built on top of NSA's backdoor in Juniper firewalls, which perhaps was compromised by the Israelis, the Chinese, we don't know, but it made every single Juniper firewall and router vulnerable and their VPNs decryptable. Just recently, we found that there may be a similar backdoor piggybacked on another backdoor in Fortinet networks. All this blowback is actually weakening national security. It's weakening consumer security, and it's creating circumstances where the greatest antagonist that the U.S. tech industry has is the U.S. military.
I don't know. I mean, the military and the military-industrial complex does recruit a lot from Silicon Valley, too.
Yeah, and then they use them to basically mess the business plans of the tech industry, because what that does is it weakens their opportunities to deploy this technology. You know, immediately after the Snowden revelation, several countries around the world banned the use of specific American companies' hardware and software inside their countries because they now know that these are being actively backdoored by the NSA and other organizations. So, you know, again, unintended consequences of blowback. The modus operandi is whack the mole you see in front of you and don't worry about the consequences. And that ends up having very serious consequences in the long run. In my mind, if you pit the military-industrial complex against the technology industry in the US, the military-industrial complex loses.
About this whole nipping it in the bud thing, I think it's still early in Bitcoin, yes, but I definitely think it's too late to, quote, nip it in the bud, you know, to find some fatal flaw that destroys it now before it gets any bigger. What do you guys think?
Yeah, the report specifically goes out of its way to say that they don't think that any terrorist organizations or non-state actors are going to use an already deployed virtual currency. Because basically what they're saying, what the argument that they're making here is that the advantage of launching their own virtual currency means they effectively are a central bank. And in being a central bank, they have all of the advantages, all of the control, the ability to set dynamics, the ability to have it be locked in and so that the administration doesn't necessarily have to be trusted. And then once you've done that, you can deploy it in most circumstances. They're like, if you have no infrastructure, no cell phones, then it's hard to do. But otherwise, it's much, much easier and less expensive compared to doing a traditional fiat currency deployment that has to, you know, be trucked all over the place and has to be protected and has to have all of these different kind of layers that make it a viable system. Whereas if you take a virtual currency, which is what they call it over and over again, VC, then you don't really have to do any of that. So that was kind of the thing. It wasn't so it was like the thing that they talked about was ISIS, the terrorist organization, has announced maybe a year ago that they were going to launch a gold currency that was going to be pressed into coins and have all sorts of insignias on it and stuff like that, because they wanted an alternative to systems that they were being locked out of. And so a virtual currency provides largely the same type of advantages there, but you don't have to protect the gold. You don't have to worry about getting raided. You know, you have to trust in encryption and do that stuff. And they also say in here, nobody has done this. And that there might have been some experiments, but it hasn't, you know, actually happened. But yeah, so that's the thing is, Bitcoin, it doesn't really seem like, and it could just be posturing for this type of report, but it seems like they are not really considering attacking Bitcoin or even any sort of existing cryptocurrency. It's much more focused on disrupting and stopping new ones that might start up that are purpose-specific driven for this type of, quote, nefarious use.
I don't know. I mean, that doesn't seem to make sense. Like, I think if there were terrorist groups using Bitcoin, they would absolutely try to attack it. It's like whatever serves their purpose.
Right. The argument was that there's no incentive for terrorist organizations to use Bitcoin. They would be better served if they're attempting to do it in a way that would disrupt a state, which
but
is, again, the
premise of
this.
But there's every incentive, because, I mean, altcoins are not valuable. They have all kinds of problems.
But they have to buy them. They would have to buy them.
You're talking about a captive audience and a captive market, and that's a very different environment in which to launch an altcoin. You know, if you think of ISIS ISIS coin as a loyalty rewards card, then it makes a hell of a lot more sense. And if you're in a captive environment where you literally are capturing ground and cities and then forcing the population to use whatever you say they will use, it's not too far-fetched. And I think it's a good analysis by Rand. But, you know, as we all know, the primary currency continues to be oil, and the secondary currency for oil is the US dollar. I think all of this, and they recognize that in the report, is really quite forward-looking. This is not about to happen anytime soon. But what they're examining is kind of the implications of all of this technology unfolding and removing control from governments. I really don't think this is in any way targeted to Bitcoin or creating any concerns about Bitcoin in general. And I think that's probably the one area where they did serve the audience, because it really does recognize the fact that in the long run and in the bigger context, Bitcoin is the fuzzy cuddly bear of cryptocurrencies, because somewhere out there, someone can build or has already built the piranha of currencies. In fact, the actions you take against Bitcoin lead to the evolution of the much nastier versions.
If a terrorist group wanted to use virtual currency to conduct their operations or whatever, why would they not use Bitcoin? It's already there. It's unraveled with all kinds of legit uses. In other words, ISIS coin would be definitely targeted and it would be probably easy to attack. Whereas Bitcoin, it's not as easy to attack. It has the network effect. It's already there. Why would they not just use Bitcoin?
Well, I think because they can pre-mine the ISIS coin.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Really? Are you serious? I don't know about that. I mean, what would give it value? Like, if people weren't buying in, right? Like, buying the loyalty rewards of... I can't believe we're talking about this. if people were not, like, buying ISIS coin with some other currency that already has value with whatever, oil, you know, gold, Bitcoin, US dollars, whatever.
Loot.
Loot.
No, I mean, seriously, like, that is what this would be redeemable for. They already have systems that do this. Again, it's hard to tell because you get mostly propaganda talking about these things. But when ISIS captures an area, they loot and they sell that stuff at discounted rates to their fighters. So, like, that's a perk of being a fighter for ISIS, is that you get discounted loot. And so, again, like, they already have the system there to essentially have a redeemable currency. It's just a question of whether or not it makes sense and what they're using compared to that.
Well, I mean, the bottom line from Rand's report is really simple. Of course, everybody's going to use virtual currencies. And the reason they're going to use virtual currencies is because, well, everybody's going to use virtual currencies. Not just bad guys, good guys, everybody, until eventually there is no one on the planet not using virtual currencies. And then we just call them, I don't know, currencies.
So I want to read one little bit from this report. It's just a little quick excerpt here. Page 42 of the report.
Can you do it in Dick Cheney's voice, please?
Oh, God, no. Yes. Please.
it's an interesting
point.
How about
George W. Bush's voice?
Non-state currencies emerge when state currencies do not meet groups' needs. So that's something that we're very familiar with, I think. It doesn't really matter what type of, you know, individual or group you're talking about. If the state currency doesn't meet your need, then a non-state currency might be a better fit for you. So here's the quote. The overall demand for virtual currencies is fully fledged competitors to centrally managed fiat currencies in countries with strong state capacity and stable macroeconomic policies is relatively small. Central banks and governments in developed countries have assessed the monetary control risk posed by virtual currencies circulating in their areas of responsibility to be low, at least at current or foreseeable levels of virtual currency circulation. There are two conditions under which virtual currencies are likely to gain traction as market actors' preferred currency option. The first condition is that the central authority does not provide a stable macroeconomic environment, and as a result, the territorial fiat currency is non-existent or its value becomes unstable.
Well, I mean, that's Argentina, basically.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, like, so they, but it's not just true for individual populations. It's also true for groups that don't like the political policies or, you know, whatever. It presents, again, an alternative. And that is the thing that this is about at its core, is that if there is an alternative that cannot be suppressed, cannot be attacked, but, you know, because they talk about cyber attacks at length in this report, too, and how a virtual currency by a non-state actor compromises their ability to conduct state-sponsored cyber attacks. You know, so I mean, it's just like all of the reasons why we think that this is a good idea, because it can't be stopped, because it gets around all of these things that are, you know, fundamentally broken in our system. These are all the reasons that they're identifying why they might actually succeed. So at least Rand agrees with the basic assessment of what the value of cryptocurrency is. And yeah, throughout the document, it really does seem like they're saying this is just a matter of time. So we should get out in front of this because it's happening.
CC Janet Yellen.
Today's episode of Let's Talk Bitcoin featured content by Andreas Antonopoulos, Stephanie Murphy, and Adam B. Levine. This episode was edited by Adam B. Levine and featured music from Jared Rubens and mindtomatter.org. Visit letstalkbitcoin.com/marketplace or click the Marketplace button on the front page of LTB to visit the LTB Network Marketplace and support the Let's Talk Bitcoin show as we near 300 episodes with the purchase of a shirt, sponsorship, or other services and items. Any questions, of course, can be sent to Adam at letstalkbitcoin.com. And I hope you have a good day, and we'll see you next time.